that we wanted to live more interconnected lives, but in a more sustainable way, given just who we are in the West. We bought land and we designed two houses. I was very thankful that the person in the other couple, Michael, was an architect. And so we built two houses with no fences. We share, you know, chickens, we share gardens, we share barbecue area. But we've been doing shared life together for over a decade, nearly 12 years. And we've shared, you know, a lot of life. It's very much like a marriage. We've had some really hard times. We've had some beautiful times. We have learned a lot about what it might look like to live a life interconnected as two families with our separate spaces, but also as one broader family.
We are so curious to talk with Daniel C. today about some of the big problems facing community living and some of the solutions that he's come up with.
Daniel C. is the co-founder of Spacemakers, a productivity consulting group for busy leaders. After experiencing physical symptoms that were the result of working in that always-on culture of internet connectivity and productivity, Daniel became passionate about helping people make space.
Space.
In their world, for the things that really matter, like family, reflection, rest, and recharge. And we're going to talk a bit with Daniel about his book, Spacemaker, How to Unplug, Unwind, and Think Clearly in the Digital Age. I've been on my phone scrolling on Twitter all day long. I'm just impressed that I can even say these words right now, given how addicted I am to my phone. But that book contains a whole new way to think about how we spend our time and some concrete suggestions about how to reclaim some space in our lives through actions both ambitious and simple. And in addition to carving out more personal space for peace of mind, Daniel recognized that he needed to push back at the atomization and isolation in our culture and actively create a sustaining community for himself and his family. Over a decade ago, he bought land and built two adjoining houses with another professional couple in Tasmania, Australia.
We're really interested in learning about how these two families and their neighbors learned to share life and land as an intentional mini community. It sounds like the community got a little spontaneous there too, as neighbors started to join in. And over the years, Daniel and his extended family learned about the limits of good intentions and the importance of structure to keep a community healthy through all seasons. Their solutions are ones that you might find yourself thinking about, even if your intentional community is just one family sharing a house. That's hard enough as it is.
I don't know what you're talking about. but welcome, Daniel. Thank you so much for joining us all the way across the Pacific Ocean. We really appreciate you being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on your show. It's great to have a conversation with you.
Great. And, you know, we just kind of found each other through one of those podcast matching apps, a little bit like online dating.
And yeah, I call it Tinder for podcasters, and it's as close to Tinder as I get, but, you know, it's kind of exciting seeing yourself go up the ranking, even if really I'm just dating people like yourselves, and you are wonderful people. I would swipe left or right, or whatever it is, that's a positive match.
Yeah, exactly. All that swiping. But to get into it, we got our normal first question.
Yeah, we're really curious, Daniel, since sustainability and co-housing and community and all of those things really have as a fundamental through line sharing. We're curious, did you have to share a room as a kid growing up?
Yeah, I got to share a room with my sister. She's 18 months younger than me. So we shared probably until I was about 12 is my guess. So pre-puberty. And yeah, it was great. We were great friends and enjoyed time together. I'm pretty sure our parents said that we started to fight like cats and dogs around that time, and they could see that there was value in separating us to our own rooms. But I have positive memories generally.
And do you think that that experience has had any influence on how you are moving through community now?
Yeah, I honestly don't know. I've heard the question and it's made me curious, actually. You obviously see a connection between sharing a room and sharing life together. It's quite possible. Maybe I'll have to go back into my subconscious sometime and discover if that led me to living the life I live now.
Well, it's hard. You know, you said, you know, you talk about how your parents would probably describe it as fighting like cats and dogs. And I remember, you know, my sister and I had separate rooms, but we would like, we were really fierce in defending our turf. Like, and I think for a while there wasn't a door. We grew up in an old house, and I don't think there was a door between the two rooms. There was no hallway.
You had areas.
Yeah. But it was just like, don't even look in here. Don't put your finger across that threshold. And
yep. What I do remember is that our family put a wall between our large room, so we ended up with two rooms. But, you know, me being the older child, I got the larger room because you couldn't quite split it in half because of where the windows was. So I certainly grew up, you know, with the inequity of the world and realizing that I had the best of it. But maybe that set me up for life more than sharing rooms. I'm not sure.
Right. Yeah. But to go back to the book a little bit, to step aside from the intentional community for a second, you know, this book, Space Maker, that I have in front of me, How to Unplug, Unwind, and Think Clearly in the Digital Age. It's got a bunch of awards. It's won a Australian Business Book Award, a couple of different best personal development book, best technology book. So it won both those. So it's like people and technology.
Yeah, it was finalist for the best technology book, but yeah, won the best personal development book in Australia last year. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. What made you write that book?
Insanity. No, I wrote a blog post about why I turn off my phone a day a week in order to rest and refresh, which I called my digital detox. And I wrote a blog post. This was, you know, probably eight years ago now. And it made, you know, it made the news. People were quite interested. You know, no one was talking about the idea that too much technology could be a problem, and that we might want to intentionally create patterns where we don't use it all the time. And so because of that, I thought, oh, there's something in this. So I thought I'll write a 20-page ebook about how to disconnect in a daily and weekly pattern, for example. But as I wrote it, I read a lot more research. I talked to clients. The book became bigger than a 20-page ebook. And I realized that actually the problem with unplugging isn't that we don't know how to do it. I mean, how complex is it to say, turn off your phone for a day a week? But it's incredibly hard to do. And the resistance is enormous. And so what I realized is there is a relationship that we have with the online world. And there are loves and longings in our heart. There are cultural stories like freedom and choice, that more freedom equals more choice, and therefore we don't limit technology. You know, there are all these stories related to the theory of technology and how it's changing our brains from a neuroplastic perspective. So unless we shift our paradigm and our relationship with the online world and then reorient our habits around healthier principles, which I kind of form the second part of the book around, then, and one of them is living in community and contemplation within that context, then we'll never be able to do the simple practices. And so I took people on this journey that I had been on to shift my mindset around technology, shift my values and principles, and then very, very practically, how on earth do you do this in a very wise way for people like myself who are actually always online? I work and live in the business world still. I still spend a lot of time. I've got a digital business. So I'm not talking to those who live in the wilderness and you know, have escaped altogether. I'm talking about people like you and I who use technology, and there's some wonders in it, and we really value what we can do with it. But we also realize that there are real problems with always being connected.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the things I noticed when reading the book is this both and perspective. You know, you acknowledge that technology is really powerful. You acknowledge the ways that it can connect us and can lift us up. You tell a story about how you used a laptop, you know, essentially from your bed to create kind of a social movement across, you know, multiple continents. And I encourage people to read that story. And you're really clear about the drawbacks for it. So I think it's not a preachy book at all, and it's got really great concrete suggestions, and it's sort of structured like a workbook. There's sort of thought experiments and reminders all through the book. But the other thing that I really liked about it is all of your personal stories. And I'm really curious. You talk about the, and I'd love for you to share this with our listeners. You know, you're talking about the current paradigm or set of ideals around life and work, you know, that we're kind of enmeshed in and embedded in right now. When you compare it to an overpowered hand drill named Ken. And I'm just really curious, like, what made you relate our use of technology to that drill?
No one's ever asked me that question on the podcast before.
Really? Come on.
I know. So, look, I was building our houses, actually, which, you know, we'll talk about later. And I needed to drill through some concrete, and I just didn't have anything powerful enough. So I asked my mate if I could borrow his drill, and he said, sure. He didn't tell me it was like a super cheap electric drill because I only had a battery-powered drill, and they just don't have the power for what I needed. But it really had one setting. It was like zero, and then it was ridiculously uber fast. And so it was so fast. I just could not control it because, I mean, when you drill, you need to start slow and create some type of guiding hole, and then you can go fast. But it was just like, I just made a mess. And I was thinking about the book and writing the early drafts at the time, and I thought, isn't this just like the way we live, that if we have an on switch without an off switch, if our life is super ridiculously fast and yet we don't have the patterns and rhythms to be peaceful and to be prayerful, to have silence and to relish relationships without being at speed, well, then we're a bit like the Ken. I called it the Ken, and he never wanted it back, actually, which is probably a sign it was a dodgy device in the first place. Thanks, Ken.
I want a T-shirt that says dodgy device with a picture of Ken.
Yeah. So there's lots of great, really personal stories all throughout the book about that, about this process of creating space. Do you want to ask number four?
Yeah, I'm like, where are we?
Okay, yeah.
We're just going to slow down and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to breathe in between questions.
Well, I actually want to notice this. You know, as you were answering that question, you spoke, you know, kind of quickly and intensely about the first part of the question. And then when you shifted to talking about space and slowing down, you slowed down. And I noticed that I responded as well. And I felt more in my body and I felt my breath. And so I think it's something we can do. It's not out of our reach. And it doesn't take much.
That sounds really wise, Charles. I'm actually just sleepy. It's early in the morning in Australia. But thank you for making it sound like I was doing something special.
You're so on brand. But seriously, Daniel, what do you see as some of the benefits for adding that space back in, you know, that we have taken up with all this technology? We didn't used to have it. Those of us of a certain age, somehow we managed to, you know, live without it before in the olden days. I don't
know
what we did.
Look, the simple answer is it makes us human again. Like there was this amazing book called iGen that I read a number of years ago by Jean Twenge, and she looked at four of the longest, most robust longitudinal studies across the US at what is happening in younger people, particularly born after Steve Jobs released the iPhone. And she basically found that culture has tremendously changed since the iPhone reached 50% saturation in the US market. And the outcomes in some areas of life, it's not all terrible, of course, but there are some areas, particularly around mental health, anxiety, depression, mood disorders, and suicide, that are just dreadful. And we know this in young people, but we're seeing it flow into all of culture where we're all feeling, you know, triggered and anxious and wired and distracted. And we intuitively know that there's something to do with the fact that we're always online that's impacting that, but we can't quite put our finger on it. And she had this amazing summary. She said, when you look at the longitudinal study, what she found is, I can't quote it, but basically all non-screen activities are linked with increased happiness in young people, and all screen-based activities, particularly new media, so swiping devices, are linked with unhappiness. And like, there's your answer. If you actually want to be a happy person and a healthy person, the stats definitely talk about in-person versus digital communities and people who spend time in relationship with people they love face-to-face live longer, they're happier, they're healthier. And ironically, I write from a productivity perspective, we're actually more productive, and there's plenty of evidence that suggests that we are not cyborgs. We're not meant to be robots. We are actually we need to sleep. We need to think. We need to pray and meditate and have deep connection with other human beings. And if you remove that and exchange it all for online living, you end up a bit of a shell, actually. You end up losing some of your humanity. So, yeah, that's a pretty good reason to unplug on a regular basis, you know. I mean, cyborgs are cool, like Darth Vader and RoboCop. Like, I really like those characters, and I definitely wear the T-shirt, but they weren't very good at relationships. They had kind of father-parent issues.
Yeah.
You know, that you wouldn't consider them particularly spiritual people. No. So there's something about being a cyborg that makes us less human, and we just need to disconnect enough to be independent from our tools from time to time.
Right. So that was thing one. What's thing two? No, I'm just kidding.
I'll be here forever.
As if that's not enough.
Yeah, right. Oh, if being human's not enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I wasn't joking about it. I was totally doom scrolling on Twitter for a good portion of the day, partly because I was just tired. Mm-hmm. And now looking back, I wish I had just picked up my guitar and just noodled badly on the guitar.
Or taken a nap. What?
Right. We did go for a walk.
High five.
Yeah. And talk to family on the technology device.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah. No, I'm convinced talking to you, Daniel. I'm convinced and I'm inspired to build in some of these practices. Cause I mean, you never use this word, but other people, you know, make it pretty clear that the use of technology in this way, in the doom scrolling and the texting and constantly checking, you know, it is addictive. And we know that like physically addictive, it releases dopamine in our brains and causes brain changes. And you talk about that a little bit in the plasticity section of your book, but you also come across really hopeful that we can, with some intention and the D word, I grew up with hippies, discipline, you know, get our humanity back. What are some of the ways that you found work for getting your humanity back?
Yeah, look, and interesting, I deliberately use the term, we run a course called Email Ninja, where we have four disciplines to get your inbox to zero each day and spend less time on email. And we wrestled long and hard because, you know, the new word is habits. Everyone's happy to change their habits, but no one wants discipline. But when we really looked at what's required, it's discipline. It starts with discipline and then it becomes a delight. You know, any hard changes begin with intentional effort and the commitment to do it regularly. I mean, just think, you can't become a marathon runner unless you start with discipline, and eventually you love to run and you wake up and want to run, but very few people start that way. And that's the same with all of these things. So yeah, to turn off your phone a day a week is definitely a discipline, and you need a lot of structure. You need the internal understanding, but you need to know practically how might you shape a day, not just without technology, but oriented around rest and reflection. So I have a chapter around digital Sabbath, or what I call the weekly day off, how might you actually design that and flip from work mode to rest mode. Because I think often, you know, you can hear all the negative things. I love Cal Newport's book, for example, Digital Minimalism, and he goes very deeply into the design of the technology and why it's bad for us. But I also feel we need to understand how to get out of this rut, and that's where people are stuck. We're more in the how part of the conversation now. So I wanted to show people how to unplug for a day, how to turn off your phone and, for example, start and end each day without your device, you know, by charging your phone outside of your bedroom, by getting an alarm clock or something that doesn't connect to the internet, so that you can actually begin and end with your thoughts and not someone else's thoughts from the radio or from the news or CNN or wherever you're hearing other people's thoughts. We talk about a digital free meal and the questions you might ask to help create conversation in a family if you've never actually had that kind of let's talk without a phone. And I'm increasingly amazed, or I'm not amazed anymore, but when I wrote the idea that we should really have a digital free meal and this is how you might start it, I thought, wow, this really is a bit dumb. Like, surely people know how to do this, because I grew up eating around a dinner table. But, you know, I was coaching a group of a group of senior leaders in a global corporate. They're all in their kind of mid-20s. They're in one of these value-based brands. It's a fantastic company and they're really smart. And I talked about a digital free meal, and one of the girls said, oh, me and my flatmates have just started having a meal every Wednesday together, and we eat around a table together, and it's awesome. It's like we're in the 1950s. And then everyone in that group goes, wow, that's a great idea. We should try that. So I was like, wow, this is not practice like universally anymore. And we need to retrain ourselves in these human habits that bring so much life. And I also talk about the research about how actually just something as simple as a digital free meal is linked with increased happiness, health, numeracy, literacy skills, less debt, less use of, you know, drugs, like lower teen pregnancy rates. Like, it's just do the simple things that make you human and it will transform your parenting as well as your own life. And so, yeah, I mean, there's obviously plenty of tips in the book, but it's simply about having some intentional patterns each day, each week, and each year to unplug within and around the context of always being a cyborg.
I love that.
Yeah, no, your book reminds me a lot of Kate Gartner's book.
Oh, yeah,
Gartner. About Kate Gartner's book about, you know, creating a more sustainable life. And, you know, you have suggestions that range from really simple, closely time-bound, easy to do right now to, you know, more ambitious of like take a 5-day or multi-day digital vacation, digital detox. Yeah. And I'm inspired, you know, as I was reading the book, I was looking at you and I were sitting in our living room mm-hmm. in front of the television. The television wasn't on. Mm-hmm. You were on your laptop. I was on my, I guess I was reading the book, mm-hmm. but the television is right there in front of us. And that's also mm-hmm. where we eat.
Yeah. No, I ruined him because when we first got together, he used to insist that we sit at the table and eat together and whatnot. And I always grew up eating in front of the TV. And so now we always eat on the couch and whatnot. So,
yeah, but we have an opportunity when we're going to move into a new house.
We have an opportunity make new habits.
To restructure the space to give ourselves some more space.
And I love that.
That sounds great. I encourage you to do it. I mean, there's Susan Morsehart, who's a media ecologist, wrote a book where she disconnected for, I think it was about 40 days and her whole family went offline and she wrote a book about the experience and she came up with 10 digital commandments for the, you know, for this age. And the first two were great. There was like, thou shalt not bring thy media to thy dinner table. But because her children kept breaking the rules and finding loopholes, she had to add a second one, which is thou shalt not bring thy dinner table to thy media. So they kept sitting around the TV instead. So, it's beautiful to just take that time and eat. There's something sacred, I think, about eating together. And yeah, ask, you know, what is your high, low buffalo? I love that question. You know, what's your high from the day? What's your low from the day? And what's some strange or interesting event like, you know, which is your buffalo. And that conversation, that question alone, it always brings about a beautiful reflection on your day, about the meaning of, you know, your day and allows you to connect in a real way, which is, you know, far better than watching what's on the news.
Right. And what you mentioned earlier about, you know, instead of letting other people tell us about our day, that's an opportunity for me, if I'm answering that question, the high, low buffalo, that's an opportunity for me to authentically reflect on and integrate my mm-hmm. own experience for the day and to be my person instead of somebody else's person.
Right. What happens if you never, you know, if you go 20, 30, 40, 60, 100 days in a row without ever taking that moment to reflect? No wonder we get anxious because all of that data is piling up and it's not getting sifted and then put away. Yeah. Or thrown away or whatever by processing it together. And then we're also seeing each other.
Right, right.
Being seen, I think.
It's beautiful. It's both.
Yeah. Yeah. Not being seen by the people who matter to us, I think, is one of the biggest reasons why people in general and young people in particular are struggling with depression and anxiety is do I matter? If the people who you're closest to don't see you because their face is already always in their phone, then, you know, what message does that send?
Yep.
Unintentionally, but
it's so important to have practices in your life where you're silent, where you reflect on the data in your life. Where you find the meaning of the experiences, so the high points and the low points, the emotions that you're feeling. If you don't stop regularly and reflect on what those emotions and thoughts and experiences mean, well, then you can't live a spiritual life. You can't actually become really self-aware. And the result is we end up running to stand still because like I chatted with a senior leader once and they said, look, I had depression like about 5 years ago and I don't have it now, but I know if I ever stop, then the depression will come back. And so I avoid it by being busy. But that only works mm-hmm. for so long. That really only mm-hmm. works for so long. And it also means that when we stop, all these terrible anxious or hard thoughts and emotions come our way because we haven't processed the stuff in our life. Whereas I am now at a stage, I'm very thankful, you know, I've experienced both experiences over time, but I can actually sit and just look at a tree or look at the sky or just sit and think and enjoy. For me, it's about praying to God, but it's also just enjoying the moment and being hopefully a bit more at peace with my soul. And that's worth shooting for, I think.
Definitely. And I want to thank you, Daniel, for your insight on this, because I used to meditate and I used to, you know, do a lot of things that I don't do now. And I am stressed out and I'm on meds for depression that, you know, thankfully they're at a good level right now, but maybe I wouldn't need them if I did a practice and then I couldn't figure out why I couldn't do my practice. So maybe. And I don't spend a ton of time. I mean, I don't doom scroll on Twitter, but, you know, it's like we're all on screens more than, you know, not. And my job is to be on screens also. So yeah, that's something for me to play around with for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, Richard mm-hmm. Bach says we teach best what we most need to learn. And
yep.
So I might sit here and it's easy in Australia, you know, like when you put something on Instagram and your life looks amazing. You know, I still habitually pull out my phone on the loo and on the toilet and, you know, it's a disgusting habit. I'm looking at the news. Do you know what I mean? Like I work until 11 o'clock at night a lot of the time because I run my own business and I lead a community. And so it's not like I have this kind of zen life. But I am, and even now it is a discipline. It is a discipline to sit down and have, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour writing in my thankfulness journal, you know, reading scripture, journaling. Like I did that this morning, but I'm like, oh, I really should be preparing for this podcast. So I'm not saying it's easy, but I see the value in it, and the rhythms and practices you put in your life end up shaping who you become. And I just encourage us to make a bit more space.
Yeah, and it sounds like you really value what you get from the discipline. And I get the vibe from you, if you will, that you like who you are, which makes it, you know, easy to be with you.
Others might not like who I am, but yeah, I think I'm great. No, no, I'm
we're
very,
enjoying
I'm,
you.
I'm thank. It's a pretty nice thing to be able to say. I mean, I'm in my mid 40s, and I think there's a shift that happens in middle, you know, as you get older as well. But there is a sense where I'm comfortable in my own skin now, and that I know that has certainly been something that's been shaped by the practices of silence and contemplation and community and all the space making practices that I have. I'm pretty grateful for that as a side benefit. Yeah.
Well, let's take a little break. That sounds like a good place for everybody to contemplate, mm-hmm. have a little space. And we'll be right back to talk about a different kind of space making.
Mm-hmm. Three-dimensional.
Yeah, your favorite.
My favorite.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode. And thank you for joining us on this investigation into the question of our generation. How are we going to live in a way that can last? We hope you'll stay with us. So subscribe. It's free. It's easy. Just click the subscribe button on your podcast app to make sure you get every episode. We also invite you to join the community that's growing up around this podcast.
Subscribe to the twice monthly newsletter at here-together.us/join. And be sure to check the show notes for more on the podcast guest and related resources. It's easy. Just click the notes tab on your podcast app or go to here-together.us/pod for all the details, links, and whatnot. Now back to the show. This is going well from our end. How's it going for you?
Yeah, great. Not what I thought we'd talk about, but that's just, if it's helpful for your listeners, that's what I'm here for. I was thinking, I don't think this is going to be about my book at all, but it'll be fun to talk about community. So,
well, like I said, I started reading it and I'm like, oh no, this totally fits in. And this really is a value to our listeners because, and maybe I can say this as we come back in, like, or maybe we can say it at the end, you know, it's like, you know, the big question really is like, how do we live together, given especially those of us in the United States, and I imagine in Australia as well, that we are trained to such individualism. And, you know, all of these practices that you're talking about, you know, being able to center, being able to find yourself, being able to create space, be mindful, be prayerful, all of this stuff, like all of that benefits everything we do when we're back in community with others. You know, when I meditate, I'm less reactive to whatever Kelly says.
You won't survive in community if you don't have, if your inner self is in turmoil. It just, you know, whatever's not transformed is transmitted. You know, healed people heal people, hurt people hurt people. Like, it just comes out. So it's a foundation for living closely with others in a really interdependent way. Absolutely.
I think we're back.
Yeah, that was good. Well, I mean, and that is one of the things we've been trying to get at. That I don't know in the, we've done 4 or 5 episodes so far in this new series on living together sustainably. And we've gotten a lot of great ideas and good advice, but I don't think we've gotten down to that like inner piece of like, how can I be a good community member and be happy and not feel like I'm giving up everything, you know, right, or being judgy and crabby to other people. And, you know, like, yeah, how do I find it within myself to live in community is as important as how do we, you know, tread lightly on the earth.
Right. But let's back up a little bit. You and your family created an intentional community. What made you do that? You created kind of the second most simple intentional community. If the first is a marriage and a family, you just joined with one other family. What made you do that?
Never heard of marriage and family being called simple before, but we'll go with that.
Simple, but not easy.
That's true. Look, so it probably began, look, it may have begun when I shared my bedroom with my sister, but from my memory, I went to Vanuatu and I was 19 years old. And I ended up spending months in this village with no internet, no electricity, where people spoke a different language. And I was one of two white fella. The other one was another 19-year-old. So you'd never be allowed to send very young people into the middle of nowhere with no communication for a long time on end. But it was an absolutely transforming experience for a number of reasons. But I started to examine my own culture through the lens of Ni Vanuatu culture. And there are some problems, obviously, with village life. I'm not painting it in an idealistic way, but one of the things that they were happy people. And they were connected people. And I saw that they lived interdependent lives. They shared their belongings and they had this sense of community that we couldn't even imagine having in Australia. We talk a lot about community, but they just lived it. And I remember a conversation I had with the pastor of the village, and he was the only person who had ever gone to Australia or anywhere outside of this tiny village. I mean, we used to hunt, you know, wild boar and catch fruit bat for food. Like, this is really a remote place. And I said to this person, what did you notice that was different about Australia and our culture? Because I was reflecting on that for myself. And he said, three things. He said, one, that we tell all of our young people they shouldn't smoke, but everyone smokes in Australia, even me. And I was like, what? and he goes, yeah. And he goes, smoke comes out of your mouth. And it's because he went in winter and Vanuatu is the tropics. He'd never seen condensation leave the mouth. So that was his way of saying that everyone smokes. The second thing he said was that people aren't friendly in the street. They don't say hi and welcome each other or feed each other, which is, you know, really true. And the last thing he said, which has always struck me, he said, in Australia, everyone puts these little fences around their house And it's just very strange. You must be very scared of each other or very protective of your stuff. And it just made me think, wow, that is so true. I mean, we're not talking about a practical fence like for an animal, but, you know, we're talking about just having a fence to say, this is mine and that's yours and keep out, essentially. And it just, it started, it's, I mean, I was only 19. It led me on this journey to discover, like you said, that we are atomized in our way of living. We live hyper-individualized lives. We're so individualized, we cannot even see from a collective perspective. And we even struggle to, you know, actually have, yeah, families and marriages and to even do the nuclear thing, let alone the extended family thing or even broader than that to do the community thing, which clearly plays out into how the world is out, you know, where the world is at right now from an environmental catastrophe perspective. And it actually begins with the way in which we understand ourselves and those around us. And so I came back to Australia and over many years started to explore community living and live with flatmates, but also had this desire to live a life without fences, both physically and metaphorically. And years later, I was married. I had one child, and we had lived in community with two other flatmates in this tiny little unit and found that, you know, as much as I would like to live like a village, I'm still a middle-class Westerner who found it hard to have a child with other flatmates around in this tiny, tiny space. So I met another couple who had a very similar journey, and we both wanted a house that we wanted to live more interconnected lives, but in a more sustainable way, given just who we are in the West. We bought land and we designed two houses. I was very thankful that the person in the other couple, Michael, was an architect and a great architect. So he could see how we could take this cheap piece of land and put two houses on it. And so we built two houses with no fences. We share, you know, chickens, we share gardens, we share barbecue area and a trampoline. You know, in the first year, we bought a shared Christmas present for our four kids. We have six between us now, three each. But we've been doing shared life together for over a decade, nearly 12 years, and we've shared, you know, a lot of life. It's very much like a marriage. We've had some really hard times. We've had some beautiful times. Michael actually died of a heart attack. He was a very healthy man and suddenly dropped dead last year in August. So we're experiencing a new chapter of loss in our communal life together. But I wouldn't trade it. And we have learnt a lot about what it might look like to live a life interconnected as two families with our separate spaces, but also as one broader family. And that is, like you mentioned, has led to a whole lot of other things that have played out in terms of others modeling what we do and learning from the lessons we've learned, not so much about building together, but the predictable patterns that actually shape our communal life together.
I'm sorry you lost Michael. That must have been really hard.
Oh, it's been devastating. I mean, he's closer to me than anyone. And, you know, we even resuscitated him. I used to be a physiotherapist, my wife a nurse, so we actually were trained in resus. And so, you know, we were the first on call and he didn't survive. But I was talking with Julia, my neighbor, yesterday, and I said, I'm going to be on a podcast. We're going to talk about this, what we do from a sustainability point of view, which I don't normally talk about. And I asked her some of her perspectives about sustainable living. And I mean, that was quite fascinating hearing from her perspective. It was her 28th anniversary, wedding anniversary yesterday. So we had a long conversation. But what she said it was, she can't imagine going through this grieving process if it was just her. And she had some interesting thoughts. She said, from a safety point of view, I feel safe here and I'm not alone. Whereas if I was just living by myself, I would actually feel really unsafe, which is interesting. And I heard someone else talk about grief on a podcast the other day and saying that they actually felt that they became scared of the dark and they weren't safe when they'd lost their husband. And yet, you know, I'm still on the block. My wife is, you know, we still care for them. We do the land. I chop the wood. So there's this sense where there's, I suppose, a sense of safety, which I'd never thought about. But also we have these predictable patterns of eating every week, of praying every week, of just sharing life together. And because they continue, there's a continuity of life that happens, even though we're all grieving deeply. But we grieve together. We're experiencing a chapter of loss together, but it's still together. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. I can't even imagine, but I can really feel like how different it would be for her and her three children not to have that ingrained relationship and proximity to you guys, to suddenly be completely on her own with three children. It would be devastating. And somehow all of you together can get through this in a way that wouldn't happen for so many other people who are just isolated in suburbia.
Yeah. And look, it's not just us as well. We've formed a broader community around us. I mean, we have a faith background, a church background, and there's a sense where, because it's hard, you know, we're all grieving and yet we're grieving in different ways. Our children are all grieving. You know, they lost their second dad. And so what we've found is there's this sense of community together, but actually even the broader community have allowed us to have support emotionally and, you know, even physically. Like, we're getting a bunch of people to help move some sheds that need to move. And, you know, like, so there's a sense where as you live a communal life, it tends to flow out into others. And that's so beautiful. I mean, I'm even amazed, you know, like, we needed to raise money, you know, pretty quickly for some things around the funeral, and just put a GoFundMe page up and just said, look, if anyone wants to help out, that would be really useful. And we raised $100,000 in 10 days without even posting it on social media. And I had to stop it because I'm like, this is ridiculous. And so I think there's a sense where you invest, if you invest your life into relationships, there's actually a richness in that that is beyond the, I must save everything myself. I must build my own super portfolio and have my own investments and have $1 million for myself. It's that same kind of picket fence mentality. Actually, what if we just created a genuine community where we loved and served and blessed other people and then trusted that when you needed, let's say, money, you'd get that, but you'd get, you know, way more than money. You'd get friendship and family and community. Which you can't put a price on.
Mm-mm. No, it's interesting that the social safety net, the government social safety net in the United States is called Social Security.
The irony.
Yeah. And, you know, Kelly and I haven't made a ton of money, and our Social Security is based on how much money we've made throughout our life. And, you know, part of what we're looking to do is to build an alternate or additional Social Security going forward, building that same kind of community where we can, you know, pour into it what are the gifts that we have, and count on, you know, not having to live underneath a bridge when we're 75 or whatever it is. Yeah, this is all really beautiful. And I just wanted to go back to a phrase you've used a couple of times, which is, I think you said predictable patterns or predictable practices, that part of what has you found that ties your community together is predictable rituals and patterns, right?
Yeah. So look, I mean, we found, you've heard this many times, or you've probably experienced it yourself. It's easy to live in the same house, even the same house with a spouse, and find that you're just two people in the same house, but you're not sharing real life together. You know, you're not really connecting. And so we realized that actually after about 5 or 6 years, particularly the seventh year was hard, we just missed each other completely, you know. And that we realized by 7 years of living together and sharing life together, you realize just how different you are. While we have, let's say, the same faith, the way we express it is actually quite different. Our personalities are different. They're Dutch, I'm half Chinese, you know, like we have different cultural heritages. And so we realized that there was just this disconnect. And so it wasn't the geography helps, and the commitment to each other absolutely helped, you know, just like that marriage commitment. You know, we committed to each other, we were all in, so therefore we had to make it work out. But it was those patterns of shared living that actually sustained us. So we were really struggling to even enjoy each other's company for a long time, but we ate together every week, week in, week out. just because that's what we committed to do. 1 week our house, 1 week at their house. You know, not a dinner party, just a rough and ready meal because we had to share meals together. We committed to caring for each other's kids and doing school drop-off and pick-up, and we committed to some other patterns. But what we realized is actually we need to do some conflict management, and that's another story altogether. And we ended up having this incredibly beautiful community after we worked our way through those large conflict areas. But it was those patterns that kept us going. And Big Dinner is probably one great example. That after we'd worked through all those interpersonal challenges and learned to say sorry for some things and actually change, actually become different people, the four of us became quite different people.
Actually,
I know. Once that happened, like the kind of, I don't know, probably the last 3 years before Michael died were just quite incredible. And rather than it just being our family, we had another couple who got married and they wanted to continue life like we lived. So they rented close to us and joined our dinner patterns and our prayer patterns. We had a bunch of other people who would come to what we called Big Dinner in the end. And we ended up with 25, sometimes more people every week. We bought a shared fridge. And so everyone who ate Big Dinner regularly from around the area, not just where we lived, would come and do Big Chop once a month, and we would all eat and drink wine and chop food and then freeze it in bags in our freezer. And then we would rotate who would provide the food for everyone. That flowed out into the street. So some of our neighbors said, we want to be on the Big Dinner circuit. So we rotated to their houses as well. And people with different beliefs than us and different experiences, but we were one extended family. We are one extended family. And then others from my church community were really shaped by this idea. And we called it a micro church. So it's kind of we eat and we pray and we learn and we serve together. And we help others around us, but we also grow in interconnectedness. So that idea just flowed out. And now in multiple suburbs, we have people who eat a Big Dinner every week. None of them actually share houses and land together, but they live within 5-minute drive of each other. And they're creating patterns of eating, of praying, of serving and learning together that is creating this sense of community because the patterns are predictable. So people can turn up every week and know it's always the same. There's always a meal. You know, there's always this warm and welcome house. And then as the meals get too big, it's like, well, actually, you're moving house or you're having a child. Why don't you start with your neighbors? Because there's no more room. You know, there's that sense of what if you could do the same thing now that we've shown you what it looks like to live a more interdependent life.
Yeah, you got to franchise it when it gets too big, huh?
Well, there is a practicality. It's hard work to have a lot of people around. And it changes with stages of life. I mean, we started with little kids, like toddlers. And so after every meal, we would have a play and there'd be like dancing and, you know, little kiddie type stuff. And now they're teens. And so, you know, like it's really quite different. And yet we have this new generation of friends who are having little babies. And so we have this kind of young and old thing happening and different. So we have two dinners now, one which is a bit more kind of little kids and one where the adults can talk. So we've had to adapt, but the patterns have stayed the same.
So Daniel, I'm just curious what it feels like to you to see all of these little seeds and blooms out around in these different weekly dinners that started with you and Michael and your families.
I don't know. Maybe this is a personality thing. I have big visions for the world and for life. I would like to see hundreds of these, and I'm disappointed that there's only a few. So maybe that's my problem. It is beautiful. And look, some of them haven't worked. Some of them have really struggled, actually, because it's really tough sharing life together. You have to get good at conflict. You have to have, like we talked about, the ability to have an inner life where, yeah, hopefully you're not, you know, constantly difficult, but at the same time, you also need to be able to apologize and reflect on the data in your life and you know, have that emotional intelligence. And sometimes people abuse you as well. So we've had to learn a lot about boundaries and when it's okay to say, yeah, that's okay, and when we need to say, no, you're not, or not so much you're not invited to dinner anymore, but actually you can't come if you behave like this. And so, you know, I'm not pretending that it's been easy, but it is human, and I wouldn't trade that for the simple life.
Yeah.
Wow. Can I say it's as simple as, on a very practical note,
if you
find someone with similar values to you who has a heart to create community, you've said this in the past that most of the communities you see have a spiritual foundation. I do think that it's critical to have a purpose beyond yourself. Community for the sake of community never seems to sustain itself, whereas community for the sake of something bigger or greater has a chance. Particularly when stuff gets hard. But if you find someone and you have a vision for a better world, well then, yeah, just a rough and ready meal, pick the same day, the same time. They cook one week, you cook the other week, and try to just learn to spend time together and invite people around who you feel like might connect and see what happens. I mean, that's really simple. And yet there's something really powerful about a meal.
I love that. And you said in our pre-call, you called it something about, I can't remember how you described, you know, your relationship and everybody else's kind of relationship to that calendar event. It's like, you have to subsume yourself. You have to let that calendar event be more important than you.
Mick always said, there's rest in the rhythm. And people have found that when there's a rhythm, there's a consistent pattern. There is rest and security in that, but you have to submit your calendar and your autonomy of your own calendar to the calendar of the community, to the patterns of the community. And like one of the things I've learned is just how ridiculously independent I am. And as much as I've gone on this journey, you know, like things like when I, one of the big lessons we've learned in our, like living, you know, the community we live in is the idea that actually when we make decisions like I want to get a dog or I want to move, you know, I get a different job, that impacts how busy I am, or, you know, I want to send my children to this particular school, which changes the rhythms of how we do school drop-offs and pickups. Like we make these decisions as autonomous units in nuclear families, even if we live in community, for example. And yet true community means we actually open our bank accounts, we open our fridges, we enable others to speak into the decisions of life that impact the relationships, just like a marriage. And if you can't do that, then there will be friction. And so it's actually a constant surrendering of your independence for the good of others. And it's helpful to let others speak into your life, but it's really painful to let others speak into your parenting, for example. Or into your finances. Like there are some sacred things in our culture we don't let people speak into. And yet the journey we've gone on is letting people basically trying to learn to be less independent and be interdependent. And look, you know, step one, at least submit your calendar so that, yeah, you don't just come to Wednesday dinner if you feel like it. You come because it's a commitment, it's a discipline, and you choose to put the community's needs before your own feelings and whatever's on Netflix or what you happen to want to do on Wednesday night. That's ground zero, but that is really hard for many people to do. But you don't get community without that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can be really rewarding. I remember a men's group happened in my house every other week for a number of years. And I was a member of that men's group and I wasn't leading it, but it happened in my house. And I remember one Wednesday night coming, driving home, just, God, I don't want to go to the men's group. I don't have anything to work on. That was my, like, that was a lie to myself, but yeah. But, you know, I don't have a need to go to the men's group. And then thankfully there was a little voice in my head that said, it's not about you, Charles. It's being there for those other men. It's not about whether or not you get a value from it. It's about being there for them. And like, how hard was my sacrifice? I just didn't go to my bedroom.
Right.
Like
that's- yeah. Yeah. You stayed in your own living room.
Yeah.
That's so
yeah.
beautiful though, because I that is the conclusion I've come with. What we still struggle with our big dinners is people just not turning up, you know, and I don't think people recognize what a gift their presence is and how encouraging it is to everyone else. And when people don't turn up, it actually takes away some of the joy of the community as a whole. And even if they feel like they're not offering something, they're not cooking, they're not teaching, but their presence is what makes us a family. And So yeah, I really resonate with what you've said. And one of the reasons I think we've worked is the four of us at least have learned to be loyal to the patterns and to the community itself. And that loyalty creates this well, which allows others to grow into that space. Because if we didn't turn up, well, then, you know, you don't have a pattern. But so you've got to start somewhere.
And you must have been having a lovely time because everybody in the neighborhood wanted part of that.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah, the dinners are certainly enjoyable. And the neighbors have been incredible. You know, the thing is, we've run out of mojo really in the last year since Michael died, and we've needed other people to pick up the pattern and to be the people who organize the dinners and share on the WhatsApp group, you know, what are people bringing? Like, I've just lost it. And that's a process of grief and you know, wrestle. But I do turn up, and that's a beautiful thing. But it's also nice to see the banner can be passed on when we need it.
Exactly.
Element of sustainability.
Right. And this, and like you talk about the seasons of community ebb and flow, and it shouldn't be the same people all the time. You should be able to pass it off to somebody else and let them shine and let them take care of you, just like you took care of them in the beginning and took care of the birth of that community in the beginning.
And do the teens know that they're going to be expected to step up here in the next couple of years?
Wow, yeah, that's a good question. We have this thing, every Easter, because we're a faith-based community, we have a pancake Passover, and we've done it for years, where we cook a ridiculous amount of pancakes, tell the story of the Exodus, and then have a food fight. We throw like chocolate sprinkles with the gnats, and we put ice down each other's backs. It's complete chaos, and it's hilarious, and the kids have loved it, telling this story of the plagues of Egypt with 10 different pancake toppings. But we just don't want to do it this year because we're really tired. And our kids said, no way. And my daughter said, she's 15, and she said, no way. We need to do it for, you know, Ella and Ben and Sophia and basically the people in our broader community who have the kids that are the age that, what, 5 and 6, you know what I mean? So we've said, well, if that's the case, you're going to have to do the cooking and you're going to help with the shopping. So it is actually happening, maybe because we're too tired to do it. But that's quite a beautiful thing that a 15 and 14-year-old are thinking about, now this needs to happen for the next generation, which I think is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well, Daniel, I'm filled with hope and inspiration, and I hope it's okay. I'm shouldering a little bit of your grief, even though it's not mine.
Just a little bit.
And thank you for sharing all of that with us and with our listeners. Mm-hmm. I hope that our listeners are also feeling inspired and a little sad.
And maybe they take a little tiny piece of it too.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they're feeling a little hungry.
Yeah.
They're pancakes. Thinking about pancakes now.
Chocolate chips.
Yeah. Yeah.
It means a lot to me, actually. It's a really beautiful idea that there's a community of people I haven't met who might take some of our sadness, but also maybe learn from the beauty of it as well.
Definitely.
Yeah, when it's shared, it's not bad, right? It's not bad to share sadness, mm-mm. I don't think.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. But how can folks find out more about you and your book and your projects? What's the best way for them to reach out to you?
Yeah. So look, if the idea of making space by unplugging as a habit and not being a cyborg, I don't talk about the cyborg in the book. I don't know where that's come out, but if that connects,
that sticks with me for sure. Yeah.
I heard Elon Musk say that we're all cyborgs, and I want to challenge that. But if that connects with you, then yeah, I'd love you to pick up a copy of my book. So Spacemaker, you'll find it on, you know, most bookstores around the world. We also run productivity training for teams. I run a Making Space course for teams, so to help them with their digital wellness. We have a trainer in Canada, so we can reach that US-Canadian time zone without me waking up at 4 a.m. And we also do very practical productivity training, like how to get your inbox to zero, you know, email ninja, how to set priorities, you know, priority samurai. So if people are curious about any of that stuff, feel free to contact me.
Fantastic. We'll put links to all of those, to the book and to your website and to all of those projects and courses in our show notes. So please, listeners, go check those out. And, you know, listeners, if you've got you know, thoughts about making space. If you've got some habits that work well for you, if you've got some habits that work well for creating community, whether it's throwing pancakes at one another or whatever it might be, let us know. You can leave us a message on our Anchor, on the Anchor website. You can contact us through our socials as well. And let's keep the conversation going. You know, you mentioned, you know, the climate catastrophe and the way in which living sustainably and you know, being able to live a little bit more densely and a little bit more interconnected is going to be part of that solution. So let's all figure out a way to do it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Daniel, for paving the way, and especially with that inner work piece so that we can be good community mates.
Yeah, exactly.
I know we're finishing the podcast, but just what you said there connected with me in terms of grief, because what I've described at a personal grief level, you know, I know that we're experiencing and we will experience grief globally as the catastrophe of the climate breakdown occurs in a very tangible way. And so while community may not feel like a strategy to fight climate change, we're going to need to be much better at sharing each other's grief and shouldering each other's pain, of holding each other in times of struggle, and to provide that kind of reminder of hope and faith and peace that actually, you know, there is a way forward. So I think the principles do play out from a sustainability point of view, both locally but also globally.
Agreed. Daniel, thank you so much for getting up and spending time with us. And thank you for your voice and your high quality microphone. It sounds great. Yeah.
Thanks very much. See you guys.
Yeah. Please thank your whole community for us. We hope and trust that you got something of value and something actionable to aid and inspire you on your sustainability journey. We invite you to continue with us on this expedition into positive impact and more satisfactory, satisfying, and sustainable living.
Subscribe to the twice monthly newsletter. It's short and sweet, full of useful resources, and of course, my favorite part, a gratuitous podcast picture.
You can also engage with us on Twitter at HereTogether1. We'll be there sharing climate news and really important photos of sustainable alpaca farms.
Yay.
Go ahead and tag us on tweets that you think should get more attention. Again, we're building a community of newly empowered local climate action takers and personal sustainability makers.
Together, we got this.
The Here Together podcast is a project of Rocket Feather Creative.